KABF and Speak Up Arkansas would like to thank our underwriters, Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, the Arkansas Education Association, Arkansas Children's, and the Arkansas Coalition for Peace and Justice, all supporting KABF, the voice of the people.
You are listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. I'm Rebecca Zimmerman. Many of us are familiar with the gender pay gap. Women earn less than men with the same position or responsibilities. But we hear a lot less about the impact this has on women, their families, and the economy as a whole. Today, we will talk about the gender pay gap and other financial and economic barriers women face in the United States. Today, we are joined by three guests. Star Haas with the University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service. She's a student there, and she's also the National Program Manager for Vote Run Lead. Maria Jones is the President of the American Association of University Women's Arkansas Chapter. And Marty North Hamilton is on the board of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families and is the Senior Vice President of Community Development at Simmons Bank. Thank you all so much for being here today. I wanted to get started, and if Star, you'd be willing to kick us off and just introduce yourself and tell us a bit about the work of your organization.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me here today. So I am representing the Women's Foundation of Arkansas, as well as my entire Clinton School team. I could not have worked on this project without my other team members, and those are Christine McCall, Mariella Hernandez, and Dylan. And the Women's Foundation has had me here today to speak on some of the work that we're doing. Thank you.
Hi, this is Maria Jones. I am with the American Association of University Women. We have an Arkansas division level and a branch in Little Rock. And at AUW, we say that because American Association of University Women is way too long to have to say. But we basically are a national organization that empowers women worldwide by advocating for their rights, researching barriers that hold them back, and delivering programs that give them the confidence and skills to succeed. We feel that we're stronger together. I'm tickled to be here today.
Thank you. It is truly an honor and privilege to have this opportunity. I don't ever take the opportunity for granted to be asked to participate in such types of forums. My name is Marty North Hamilton, as Rebecca mentioned, Senior Vice President and Director of Community Development and CRA, and CRA within banking is the Community Reinvestment Act for Simmons Bank. So I have all of our 7 state geography, which equates to 35 different, what we refer to as assessment areas, managing for the bank what will soon be roughly $18 billion in assets. So very excited to be here. And I am a proud board member of Arkansas Advocates. And in addition to that, I also, separate from my job, conduct a lot of training on cultural competency and unconscious bias, which I think will have a major impact, or there are various points within this conversation today in which those two issues will be really relevant to addressing the pay equity gaps.
Okay. So the gender pay gap was in the news again last week because some new research suggested that pay disparities for women are actually greater than what has been estimated by the government. What is the pay gap between men and women, and how does the disparities vary between white women and women of color? Anyone?
So the Women's Foundation of Arkansas is so excited to be releasing the first gender equity scorecard. And we conducted research over the past year. It was intense research, and we found that there is a significant gap between women and men here in Arkansas in the workplace. And currently, Arkansas women make 71 cents to the dollar for men. However, that is for white women. For women of color, it is quite a bit lower. And so the gender equity scorecard is really just honing in on this disparity and, you know, trying to bring just a really, problem-solving, straightforward approach to solve this problem.
You know, one thing that's interesting is there's almost as many different figures as there are research studies about what exactly the pay gap is. And one of the basic things that we all remember is that basically it's an earnings ratio. It's the ratio of women's median earnings to men's median earnings. And you'll see different organizations coming up with different figures. AAUW is showing that the pay gap overall is 80%. That means that Equal Pay Day comes in about April. So what happens when a white male works until December, a female would need to work until the next April to get equal to what the male earned. So depending on which statistics you use, which Census Bureau figures, you come up with slightly different numbers. The interesting point that the article made was that there's a lot of factors that aren't even considered in that. And that was one of the major things was how much work time do females actually do, because they're the ones that need flexible working hours or keep the children, those kinds of things. So that is one of the factors that was interesting in that recent article that was pointing out. There's a lot of things that are not considered when we do our research studies and come up with those different percentage points.
Well, I can say I have personally reviewed several studies that talk about the educational level of Black women in particular. We tend to be among the most educated in the country, but yet we experience, even with greater and higher levels of educational attainment, we are still facing this pay gap. And then if you were talking about Black males as well, we know that some with a college degree will be paid the same as a white male that may or may not have a high school degree. So we know that there are a variety of reasons why those disparities exist between gender and race and ethnicity. And as the previous person just said, I think there are so many complicated layered factors that go into this that it'll be very, very hard to simply pinpoint. I think we can get on or address some of them, but the more systemic, deeply rooted causes for this, I think will take a lot more reflective research and study within institutions.
Well, I think that's a good segue into my next question. I mean, a lot of times we hear the argument that the reason women make less than men is because they take off work to take care of their child when they're young. Is that the case? Is that the whole story? What are some other factors that come into play? You've hinted at obviously racism being one for women or of color, but what are some other issues that might be of play? And if just going home to take care of children is really that big of a part of it?
I would say from the research that we conducted on Arkansas women for this gender equity scorecard, it really varied. We studied women who had children and women who did not. And what we found to be true was that this pay gap was really there regardless if they were raising children at home or not. So it's almost a myth that, you know, it's due to just raising children. And, you know, the surveys that we conducted were actually statewide. So it was very representative of the entire state and, you know, really just covered women with kids and without kids. And the pay gap was still there for both.
And that really replicates what we're finding nationally with AAWs. We try to control for that. The other thing that people mention is, oh, well, women just go into lower paying jobs. They don't go into the STEM jobs. And they aren't in STEM jobs as much as men. However, when you control for all of those factors, we still found a 6-7% discrimination factor. So there is the factor of discrimination against women.
Wow. When I think about this, I personally do not know any mothers that have taken time off to raise their children. So when I think of the communities in which I work with that are low wealth individuals, they can't afford not to work. So having a child, you may or may not take off a maternity leave. You may or may not have 6 weeks off at the end of this. You may be working or have no choice but to continue to work. in order to provide for yourself and your family. So I would say that disparity may exist, but I really think it depends on where you are on the economic ladder to begin with, to be able to have the opportunity or the luxury to even consider that as even an option. So I think there are a lot of women in which taking off is not even an option to consider to raise children. They have to work. And then they do the best they can in cobbling together daycare and childcare and transportation and all of those other issues. And I think all of that plays into this disparity as well.
And if you have any questions for our guests, you can give us a call at 433-0088. We are talking right now about the gender pay gap and what could possibly be the cause of this besides outright discrimination. So again, if you have any questions, 433-0088. Income is one thing, but how do the pay gaps affect women's wealth over time? I'm thinking about not just income directly, but things like retirement and investments and other fancy sounding things also.
Well, obviously, if you have tremendous financial stress just to meet basic needs, you are not planning for a future. I often say that some populations live strategically and others live tactically. Some people live in 24-hour cycles. I've got to accomplish these things in this day, and that's all that I can really afford to focus on. So the ability to think long-term or to set monies aside to think of an IRA or 401k can be challenging because you're more focused on trying to survive the here and now. And so over time, as you approach, hopefully, retirement age, you tend to end up being a lot short, and you're really dependent upon federal programs, which once again, if you've been underpaid or underemployed or have had these pay disparities throughout your entire life cycle, that now means whatever federal benefits you may receive are going to also be lower. And so it's a really challenging structure. There are many groups that try to provide education as it relates to the importance of savings, but then you've really got to meet a person where they are and determining is that or how can you help them accomplish that goal. For women with higher paying jobs and education, they tend to work for companies that have 401ks that make it a little easier to have that money invested over time. Typically, we are more cautious as women. We don't do a lot of speculating on the stock market. We want to go really safe and sure. And you know, that also has a lower over time return on the amount of money that you would particularly earn. So I think there's a lot of different reasons why our retirement savings and investments may look substantially different than our male counterparts. But I think it's because so many of us are managing households and we are literally just focusing on the here and now.
Well, you know, college debt is another area where if you're not making as much as the males that went to college the same time you did, it's going to take you way longer to pay back your college debt. And also, we find in research that the pay gap gets worse as women get older.
Something to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
Marty, going back to what you were talking about, that women, in terms of investments, play it safer. I've heard some arguments that the reason that is because how girls view themselves as they're growing up, and boys are told it's okay to take risks. If they fall on the playground, it's okay, but girls don't go out there, you'll get your dress dirty, things like that. Do you think that that really is the cause? Do you think that that plays a role in women playing it safer? Oh, we've got a call in. You're on the air. Do you have a question for our guests?
Yes. Were you able to control for the gender of the person who made the salary decisions?
I think he's asking for the bosses and managers who were deciding how much to pay the female employee. Did you, in your study, look at, was that manager a female or male? Is that correct?
Correct, exactly, yes.
So currently the scorecard is just set up merely as an assessment. It doesn't grade on whether the manager or superior is a man or a woman. But there have been discussions that there needs to really be two versions of the scorecard, one specifically for leadership in the organization, and then another version for employees.
Right. I'm just curious. I was just wondering if women pay women more than men.
Yeah, I think that would be an interesting thing to look at.
Well, absolutely. Thank you so much for your question.
Thank you. Okay. Going back to you, Marty.
Sure. Yes. I think depending upon which generation you're in, that answer or that impact will vary. So being a Gen X, and I always shout out Gen X, the overlooked, never referred to, and everyone seems to have forgotten we exist group between millennials and the baby boomers. I think it depends a lot regionally where you are in the country. I think it also depends on where you grew up on that economic ladder. I know I was not raised to take a lot of risk because you couldn't afford risk because the rebound could be so much more challenging and take so much longer. So I think it really depends on a variety of factors, but I wouldn't totally eliminate the idea of gender roles. The girls behave one way and guys are encouraged to behave another.
And in the different financial investments and housing and things like that, do you see from a banking perspective, do you see other differences between men and women in what they're able to access and not?
So taking the housing issue in particular, depending upon the race or ethnicity, the age in which you start considering home ownership is substantially different. Persons of color tend to consider home ownership much later. So you've missed out on 10, 20 years of possible equity accumulation just by delaying, for whatever reason, getting into home ownership. So I think that is pretty impactful, especially over the long term. Also, I experience a lot of people who they get in their first home and they view it as their forever home. There's a great fear of selling and trying to get financed again and trying to qualify for another mortgage. So they may not want to repeat that cycle again. They feel like, I got in, that's enough. Where you can see...
I feel that way about student loans.
Oh my goodness, those student loans. And Sallie Mae, someone you can't get out of your life once you go with student loans, unless you pay them off. But so you have that fear of, okay, I went through a lot to get this asset. Do I want to try this again? So you have that intimidation and fear often. Whereas I see some individuals who see it as investments. They don't get connected or attached to a property. They're like, I'm going to be in this home for this period of time. I'm going to sell it, flip it, move to the next one. And they kind of move around a lot more fluidly. So I definitely think that plays into the mindset and the risk model of some women.
And going back to the new Women's Foundation scorecard, we've talked about the pay gap, but what are some other economic and financial issues that you looked at in that report? And do you want to talk a little bit more about how you went about the study and who you reached out to and things like that?
Yes, that would be great. So my team, my Clinton School team and I, we worked very closely with the Women's Foundation of Arkansas. And we set up surveys and discussion groups across the entire state. And we really covered every corner of the state. And, you know, we were proud to be able to do that. So it wasn't just this one central voice here in Little Rock. The studies were conducted over the time of a few months. And we began just by assessing what was important to women and what we were hearing. And the scorecard actually breaks that down further. But one of the obvious indicators across the board, of course, is that childcare, the lack of, company funded or provided childcare is substantial here in Arkansas. Something else that was interesting was mentorships and mentor groups. You actually see women, especially in the workplace, working together now to form, advocacy groups to inform one another, to build each other up. And that's something new that we found that was happening across the state and in different sectors. And that's another important part of the scorecard is we assessed all different kinds of sectors. We looked at education and banking and other fields and just really got a good grasp of what women were facing in the workplace in Arkansas today.
Did you see higher levels of discrimination in different fields or...
I wouldn't say that it was different fields in regards to if you were in what is considered like a higher paying field. Mm-hmm. But what was common is we've all heard of the good old boys club. We heard stories like that quite often. And it was on all levels of, employment. We heard about it from leadership levels all the way down to the bottom. Women are ready to stand up and be seen as, incredible partners in our business community. And one of my favorite quotes that we found is, one woman said, well, I can't golf, but I can drive a golf cart. Women are ready now to get involved and, to have their voices heard and to eliminate those boy clubs that do exist still today.
And I think that's a good point. I've been focusing on kind of some negative aspects, but you're saying, I guess, kind of to counteract this old boys club, women are forming these mentorship groups. Do you want to talk a bit more about those and what those look like around the state?
Sure. And to be honest, my research hasn't been in depth in those areas, so I'll speak to the best of my ability. Mainly we were seeing a lot of women that work in IT actually. And then of course, women lawyers, they have a group. I know there's one in Little Rock and forgive me, I cannot remember the name of that. But we saw just groups like this rising up and we were seeing them rising up externally and internally, across the board and across the state.
I believe it's the Arkansas Association of Women Lawyers, AAWL. Yeah.
Yes, that's correct.
So as a banker in our space, they're normally referred to as affinity groups. So you have persons with similar characteristics who come together to educate, inform, increase awareness, and provide support. Because sometimes you just need someone who will listen to whatever your concerns or issues are. So affinity groups are definitely growing. One of the ways I like to repackage a phrase because, we often say, the good old boys network. So in the space where I'm in cultural competency, I talk about affinity. So there's affinity bias that occurs in hiring and most people are completely unaware that they're doing it. And that oftentimes includes the very persons that we're referring to. People like to hire and work with people that are like themselves. And so we give more unconscious credit, mm-hmm. whether it's beauty and a whole lot of other biases that each and every one of us have. None of us escape having various biases going on unconsciously at the exact same time. But people are like, okay, I want to get someone that has a similar outlook than me, has a similar background than me, the similar thought process than
just
me.
Just as awesome as me.
Exactly. And so what happens is people, we have very limited visions. And so a lot of times if there's not a woman in that circle, they replicate it over and over again with men. And so I think for women, one of our challenges is, especially in meetings, I cannot tell you, and I can imagine this came up in the research, the number of times we can be in a meeting, can say something just brilliant, be completely ignored, and then a man can come back and express the exact same thing and it be validated, or the number of times that women try to speak up and they are spoken over. I think a lot of times we really struggle with appropriate assertiveness, when we should speak up, when we should really make sure or demand our voices be heard. And I think that also comes into play in partly of how we're viewed is whether or not we are a leader, whether or not we are a risk taker, whether or not we should be given an opportunity to lead certain projects. So I think there's a lot of things that are going on within that quote unquote good old boy circle as well.
And again, we are talking today about the gender pay gap and other financial and economic barriers that women face in the United States, and especially here in Arkansas. If you have any questions for our guests, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And going off of what you said, Marty, I think probably all of y'all have heard of Lean In from Sheryl Sandberg. Berg of Facebook. And there are some really positive responses to her argument, but there's also a little pushback saying, yeah, in an ideal world, we would step out more, but women are retaliated against if they do that. Does anyone want to speak to that, or if you, what you think about that, or agree with that?
I think that women always have to find a fine balance between being soft and hard, right? And in my work that I do outside of Arkansas, and of course in Arkansas, that's commonly discussed, whether it's in the workplace or elsewhere. And so, you know, women tend to be viewed as mama bears at times. And so we're constantly having to just balance if we're going to be soft and hard and how to get our point across.
Absolutely. I think this idea of us being sweet and nice all of the time can be challenging. I'm a strong personality, unapologetically so. And so any manager that I've ever had to have an appreciation for that, or it's not going to work. I appreciated her lean in, but I'm a push forward kind of person because I feel that I represent a constituency everywhere I go, and it's my responsibility to make sure their voices are heard. Sometimes they may not like the delivery method, but I think it's important. Sometimes that is well received and sometimes it's not. But as Star was just mentioning, we do have to balance and figure out, okay, when do I dial up, dial back, what degree? And so there's that constant juggling that I think men just don't worry about at all. We have to be mindful whether or not there'll be retaliation and promotion opportunities or growth opportunities or training or leadership projects that could help you propel your career. All of that, I think, comes into play based upon how people view gender roles in particular.
And you can't underestimate the need for women mentors for women in organizations, because that's how that helps you navigate when you maybe you're pushing too hard or say, well, maybe you should try this. If you've got other women in the organization that can give you a roadmap or say, hey, you need to think about this, that really helps other women be successful. So you've got to have the mentality of helping other women to be successful.
And I mean, we're talking about this in very practical terms, but this is pretty depressing that women have to even think about this.
It is.
So going back to the Women's Foundation scorecard, one thing that I found the most shocking and disturbing was the amount of women-led households that are living in poverty. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. So what we found is, number one, I would say, is it's important to note that 53.1% of the workforce is actually comprised of women. And so women, you know, when they are having to worry about childcare and leading the household and income, those are high barriers. And so the scorecard just helped assess that and kind of target those areas and hopefully provide just some solutions to the future.
Mm-hmm. And you have to think too, I mean, these women-led households, they, a lot of them have children that they're trying to take care of too. And this pay gap is directly affecting those children's futures as well.
Well, that's why things like raising the minimum wage is so important, because when you raise the minimum wage, there's a lot of women-led households that are surviving on minimum wage. And so that's something that can have a nice impact on a lot of women-led households.
Okay, we talked a bit about this at the beginning of this show, but women of color face greater discrimination than white women. Can we talk a bit more about those barriers that they face and some reasons behind that? I mean, obviously it's racism, but...
So I think a lot of it is unconscious. I'm going to be honest. I think a lot of people do not set out with the intent to do it. I think it ends up being what occurs, and people are just aren't aware with, and they don't see what they don't see. There was a prominent company that several years ago looked around and they looked at their employee base and they said, who's missing? And they realized they had very little racial or ethnic diversity. And so they engaged in removing the name and address block off of resumes that went to hiring managers. And they gave them numbers. So a person could not see the name or the address or zip code or high school or college even to which the person was associated with. They noticed that those getting interviewed and ultimately hired started to look a lot different. So what did that tell us? For a lot of people, we do realize that non-European sounding names have an employment penalty assigned to them. If it's more unusual and it strays too far from traditional names, it's held against you. And oftentimes, I'm not originally from Little Rock, but I am from Arkansas. And there's a big difference about being from Little Rock and not from Little Rock. Like, which high school did you go to? I'm almost 50. And that amazes me that people still ask each other that question. And it becomes, oh, you went to this high school versus that high school. And depending upon how you viewed that high school, unconsciously is playing into how you're viewing those resumes. A lot of people don't think about that. The zip code in which you live, how people view or perceive people to be from a certain zip code, all of those things play into it. Which college you attended or didn't attend. All of those factors, I think, disproportionately impact women of color. Because if you went to a high school or a college that the hiring manager or recruiter had a certain filter in which they were using toward that, and then you layer in a name that is not something that they are accustomed to, all of those things play into employability. I personally have seen that happen to me. And it was amazing because I sent a resume out several years ago under two different names, the exact same resume. I got a call back on one and not another. So I've heard of various research studies in which that has been done. And that has happened to me here in Little Rock personally. And I thought, wow, this is interesting.
And can you explain, you mentioned implicit bias. What is that?
So implicit or unconscious bias, like I said, we all are biased. You can't help but be because it's develops over a lifetime for a variety of different reasons. In one of my workshops, I talk about how I'm a heels girl. You'll rarely see me in flats. When I see women in flats, I have to push through and go, they're a good person, but that outfit would look so much better if they had on heels. You know, that type of thing. So we all have all these various things going on. So depending upon the filter or framework in which is operating that you may or may not be aware of, we make short, quick decisions. And we decide in group, out group, like us, not like us, threatening, safe, instantly. And we're not even aware that those are going on. And I think that plays into a lot of it. So if I'm from Searcy, Arkansas. So once again, not being from Little Rock, it's like, oh, then it's a scramble. Like, okay, so you didn't go to a high school here. So where do you go to church? Then it's like, oh, so that means now you have to be associated with. So it just goes on and on. And if you can finally find that connector, then people will let you in. But if you keep answering the question the wrong way, people will push you away. So I think with women of color, and especially women from lower socioeconomic communities of color, it could be extremely daunting because you may not have those connections that are readily available for other groups. You may not shop in the same area. I mean, just something to live in the same community. And I think all of those things that don't create those immediate connections can be not so much held against you, but I believe they can cause you to be overlooked. Mm-hmm. Or directed to different careers. I've known of individuals who you're looking at their credentials and they applied for a job at a certain level. They didn't get that particular job and they were recommended and directed to something else. Or they felt like they couldn't get that particular job because they didn't have the social network to make those proper connections. So they went for a lower paying job. So I think there's a lot in there. But I know the name, address, zip code, and the school itself oftentimes are ways in which that type of bias creeps in.
And that makes me think, I was actually told once I was about to take a low paying job. And I had a friend tell me, don't you dare do that, because if you take that job, that's going to impact your income for the rest of your life. And so I guess, you know, also on a lot of resumes, especially for big companies, they ask you your salary history, and this perpetuates the gender pay gap.
That's actually one of our policy initiatives in AUW, is to try to get the salary history off of every application possible. They've done it in New York. They've done it in Boston. So it's not just a gender thing. It's a race thing. And so there's no reason why the salary needs to be on your resume, on your job application, because the job is worth a certain amount and they should be paying you regardless of what your prior salary was. That was a big eye opener for me. I've been an employer for too many years. And when I first heard that, I was like, really? How am I going to? And I thought, no, it doesn't matter what they made before. It's especially I worked in work in state government. So, and it's pretty prescribed, but there's little negotiation things that you can do with that. And there are things you can negotiate other than your salary. So there's one Heifer International does not have a salary history on their job application. We'd like to see the city of Little Rock not have a salary history on their job applications. We asked mayor's forum, we asked all the candidates for mayor if they supported taking the salary history off of city job applications. And Frank Scott was one of the people that said yes, he would support that. So we're looking forward to hopefully working with the city of Little Rock to see if they can remove the salary history on their job applications.
I refuse to answer the question. I stopped doing that years ago. So in an application, I won't answer it. And even in an interview, when they attempt to, I pivot the conversation. I will not answer it because of that very thing. I discovered a long time ago what you just mentioned. If you, because of the lack of awareness or understanding, and maybe you were just needing a job and you don't really know what the pay options were and you came in at a low figure, there are some entities that will kind of say, she'll work for this. Mm-hmm. And they'll hold you to that. And so if they offer you 2% more than that, then, she'll take the job because it's more than what she was making previously. So about 15 years ago, I stopped answering the question altogether. It's like, let's just talk about the salary for this job. What I made previous doesn't matter. Let's focus on this job. And this is what I believe I should be paid.
Well, you'll, as a board member of Arkansas Advocates, you'll be happy to know that we are not asked that. Again, this is Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. We are talking about the gender pay gap and other economic and financial barriers that women face in Arkansas and the United States. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 433-0088. So we think about this just impacting women, but I kind of mentioned a bit earlier, the gender pay gap doesn't just impact women. It impacts their families. It impacts the economy. Do y'all want to talk a bit about that and what you've been seeing in different research?
Of course, it affects families. I mean, in terms of the children and even husbands, really the pay gap is just a real negative influence on families, because it doesn't hurt just the woman. It hurts her partner if she's married. And so if you're not, they're both working. I mean, that's a new thing in this economy. I'm a baby boomer. So most of baby boomers are both working. And if your family income is, you're both working lots of different jobs just to try to pay the bills, living day to day, it's not good. And that's why, again, increasing the minimum wage is very important, because women bring home a significant amount of income for their family. So it's important for their family and their children for them to be paid what they should be paid. And I'll make one point. There is one country, I think it's Norway, where men are required to take maternity leave. And if you take the idea that it's only the woman that takes maternity leave off the table, then all of a sudden the gender pay gap disappears. And so that was pointed out to me that in Norway, that I think it's Norway, that they have no gender pay gap. And it's because they require that men also take maternity leave. And so it's not just a female thing anymore. So that one that supports the family, that's a great start for children to have both parents as their caregivers.
I definitely think of it in the terms of opportunity cost loss. So when you think of not earning equal pay, then that means that amount of money is being denied your household, which directly impacts the quality of life that you and your family, especially children, have. It will impact your ability to invest, provide quality experiences. That lack of money to invest in your future, college education, all of these things that many of us take for granted, because you are, okay, this is the amount of money that I earn. I have to figure out how to budget and live off of this appropriately. But just think, if you're getting paid 20% less, that's 20% more that you're missing out on that you could be deploying into the economy or helping your family be more stable and get ahead. So I think there's a great disservice to women by underpaying women. As you mentioned earlier, that December to April, that's pretty powerful to know that big of a salary gap exists, that you have to work that much longer to be on par. And think about the long-term consequences, not only to that family, but to the economy. We're missing out on our gross domestic product and a lot of different economic factors just by that lost wage that is occurring.
Yeah, African-American women have to work till July 31st. Hispanic women have to work till November the 2nd. Those are the equal pay days this year. It's just horrendous.
Well, on that note, let's talk about some solutions to the problems that we outlined. What are some policies that we could adopt as a state or as a nation that could help address these issues?
I would say, first of all, by holding ourselves accountable. And so that's what the Women's Foundation of Arkansas Gender Equity Scorecard is all about. It's not punitive in any form or fashion. It is just a way to change the way that Arkansas businesses think. And that's really what this is. You know, before this research done the past year with the Women's Foundation of Arkansas, there really wasn't a lot out there. We found that as far as gender equity scorecards, as far as them being in other states or even other countries, they're not really out there. We actually struggled to find significant examples on which to build this. Now, we did find some, one being in St. Louis, but the gender equity scorecard is an excellent start. And I'll say it again, it is not meant to be punitive. This is something that leadership and employees alike can use to just assess where they're at, but not only assess, actually like find out about some cool, new, interesting ideas. And that's what a lot of the feedback has been, is they're like, wow, I never thought about it this before. I never thought about it this way. I never thought about implementing this. And so that is what the Women's Foundation of Arkansas is really bringing to the table with the Gender Equity Scorecard.
And I think that that effort is very, very important, because what we saw in the last legislative session when we tried to run an equal pay bill that was pretty comprehensive, it was the business community that fought it and defeated it. And it was just basic equal pay things, like making it where you couldn't prosecute someone for sharing their salary information. Just lots of really simple things. And the business community just, it never got out of the first legislative committee. So what the Women's Foundation and what you all did is went straight to the people that were having the most discomfort with some of these initiatives and help them see how they can do some things and what changes that they can identify in their own businesses. So we'll be out there still trying to pass equal pay laws and that kind of thing, but sometimes you can't change it with laws. It's sometimes that you have to go into where people are and help them see what changes need to be made. Another policy thing from our standpoint is, like I mentioned before, was getting the salary history off of applications, off of state government applications, off of city applications. If we could get that done, that would be great.
Well, one of the ideas she already addressed, and I was just sitting here thinking of possibly another strategy on addressing our state legislature, which is a very interesting state legislature we have now, as it relates particularly to anything in an equity type basis, whether it's landlord-tenant or it's anything equity-based. I think sometimes we have to, unfortunately, separate ideas. So I personally think this notion that you shouldn't be able to discuss what you make is a really bad practice that I think is really firmly embedded in Arkansas business here. Some people are rewarded, quote unquote, for being better negotiators than others. But I do know of an instance of a company, I'll protect the location of the company, that accidentally an email was sent from a person with an HR that disclosed the salaries, and individuals saw the list, and it was immediately, wait a minute, I do this job which has a higher title and this, that, and the other, but I'm making less than this person. They end up, out of fear, went ahead and fixed it. I think another issue that we have in pay within business is tenure. I can't speak in education and in some of those type of environments, but oftentimes you're penalized for being a long-term employee nowadays. So if you're on an old, outdated pay scale, your pay scale doesn't get updated as time goes by. So I know individuals who may have been with a company 30 years and they're making less at 30 years than persons coming in today as a new person coming in to do the same job. We don't adjust these things because, one thing, we don't talk about it. The person doesn't know what the other person is making, and they may assume they're making, oh, well, that person makes more than me. So their conversations are off base. But I've seen that so many times where the penalty of staying with the company, especially if you're in the same position, is actually costing you money. And I don't think that's right either. I think there needs to be adjustment over time as well, but that doesn't normally happen either. I don't think that would pass at the state legislature. I'm just putting that out there.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that was in for-profit companies. I know there's some talk about that right now around teacher raises and different pay. Oh, we have a call. Just a second. Man. You're on the air. Do you have a question for our guests?
I just want to make a comment.
Okay.
I've been listening to your program. I'm sitting here exercising, so I may be out of breath.
But okay.
A good topic, good worth talking about. And when you talked about the older worker, that certainly sits home with me. I mean, I'm not old, I guess, but I'm 55, and I've been in the same industry 26 years. And it'd be so strange to go out and apply for a job after a quarter of a century in the same industry. But, at my age, when you do a resume, I don't think dates are as important. You don't want to put dates. You don't want to say, well, I was working in this industry during the Gulf War. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You point those things out. And I want to point out a movie to you that's really good about making the change to another career for an older worker. But there's a movie out there called The Company Men with Tommy Lee Jones, and it's fascinating. It's about a company that has a massive layoff of all their middle-aged and older workers. It's worth watching. But I want to make that comment, and I appreciate y'all. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
I think that's a good point. Marty also mentioned the pay discrimination for men of color. There's a very narrow idea of what an ideal worker is. And if you don't meet that narrow frame, you're considered by many as not ideal, and your pay reflects that and your opportunities reflect that. So I think that the caller had a good point. Going back to what you were saying, Marie, about the trying to pass the laws around discrimination for being penalized for fighting back against your salary history, can you talk about the Lilly Ledbetter Act and at the federal level and what impact that's had and the limitations of that? And
sure. Lilly Ledbetter, if you don't know, she worked for Goodyear Tires. And she was out there slinging tires and rubber and doing all the heavy lifting and crushing hours and work of all the men, mostly men, in the factory. And towards the end of her career, someone slipped a sheet of paper in her locker that was a listing of all the salaries. And she discovered that there were people that had way less responsibility, that she'd been discriminated against for years. And so she was about at retirement, and some of it was due to physical wear and tear from working that hard of a job. So she decided to go to the EEOC, which she did. And she made it all the way to the Supreme Court, and she would have won her case, except they said that she had to have claimed that she was discriminated against within the first 7 days or something of her when it happened. Not when she found out, but when it happened. And so that AAUW was one of the organizations that kind of supported her in her national barnstorming and everything else about equal pay. And so the first law that President Obama signed when he was in office was the Lilly Ledbetter Equal Pay Act. And what it did is it changed it so that if you don't find out that you were discriminated against until way later, there's not that cutoff. And so there's other legislation that's at federal legislation that to help with equal pay. And maybe we may see it revive since we've got two different parties in Congress. But it nationally, there's a lot of things that could be done nationally. There are a lot of things that be done at the state level and need to be done at the state level. But I think where we've decided to focus is more locally at the city level, because that's more winnable. And to focus on one issue like getting the salary history off of a application. So, because there are lots of nice, wonderful, big battles you try to win at the national level, but if you can't get there, you make the change you can make where you can make it.
And maternity and paternity leave, that's not a given either, right? Depending upon where you work.
It's maternity leave. That the most recent thing that passed was for state employees to have maternity leave, paid maternity leave. That was Missy Irwin and Clark Tucker did that. The next step would be, and it's actually just for women. It needs to be for men and women. The next step would be to try to have some kind of maternity leave program, but you get into private business and you're telling private business that they're going to do certain things. That's a hard sell. That's a hard sell for a state legislature to have to do. Marty, did you have any thoughts about?
Oh, I just totally agree. I mean, the government is one thing. Getting into private, man, that will be challenging. Even though I think those of us participating in this program understand it would be good business and it would help the bottom line in other countries have demonstrated, you know, decade after decade about having appropriate maternity and paternity leave is actually good for a company. I think that's hard to sell that idea currently, as you just pointed out, you know, because a private business feels like they know what's best for their business, their operations, what they can afford. But I think there's a lot of education, and over time, maybe we'll get there.
And I think that leads to another point. I mean, it just seems like this is bad for business. If you keep, like you mentioned before, keep hiring people that are just like you, you're going to have people that keep having ideas that are just like you, and you're missing out on a lot of innovation.
Absolutely. I mean, we hear those reports all of the time, and you can look at companies that truly embrace inclusion, and inclusion comes in a variety of different forms, that they are more innovative. Their bottom line is better. They have stronger bonds and connections with the company. They feel employees feel more valued and appreciated. I think sometimes certain industries and certain companies, it just takes them a little bit longer to catch up with the rest of the country on some of those attitudes and practices. So I'm optimistic over time, as one or two companies are able to show, hey, it does work, that others will want to replicate it. But I think we've got a lot of work to do.
And speaking of a lot of work to do, that also makes me think, I wasn't born at the time, but wasn't it not so long ago that women couldn't even get credit cards without a husband signing off?
That is correct. In the 70s, it hasn't been that long.
A lot of legalized
discrimination. This is one of my policy places, because this is a spot that's very important to me. Most people think of discriminatory practices in silos, and they don't think of the cumulative impact and the timeline of things. So you may have had liberation in one area, but there were six other ways in which legalized discrimination still existed. And so until all of them were gone, you still were dealing with various impacts on your life. So I think of, in particular in my case, since I am responsible for Regulation BB, my favorite one, that is the Community Reinvestment Act, most people don't realize that was the last of legalized discrimination. That was 1977, and rules didn't go into place until 1980. So a lot of people think of the 50s and the 60s, and I'm like, yes. However, there were still a lot of legalized discriminatory public practices and laws that were on the books that have direct impact to this day on the economic well-being and mobility of communities right now that we're still trying to figure out ways to address. And so, of course, that will impact women, it impacts children, it impacts wealth, it impacts so many different things.
Well, thank you all so much for being on the show today. We really appreciate it. I think we had a great discussion. Arkansas Advocates will be back next month with our What to Expect in the General Assembly discussion. So everyone take care till then.
The following program is made possible in part by Organic Valley Family of Farms, organic and family owned since 1988. Learn more at organicvalley.coop. By Park Foundation, dedicated to heightening public awareness of critical issues, and by support from listeners like you, helping air Bioneers radio programs worldwide free of charge. Visit Bioneers.org.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature.
Humans are inventing a new fire, not dug from below, but flowing from above, not scarce, but bountiful, not local, but everywhere. Not transient, but permanent, not costly, but free. And this new fire is flameless.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
We stand at the threshold of a historic opportunity in the human experiment to reimagine how to live on Earth in ways that honor the web of life, each other, and future generations. It's a revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart. In this series, The Bioneers...